Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Heading to the moon? Make sure you find out what you can and can't do before you get there. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Simon, and you are joining me and my co-host, Garrett, in the studio today for our February space article. Hey, Garrett.
Hello, Simon. Hello, listeners. Garrett, good to be here.
What's this article titled?
It's called Lunar Law. That's an interesting title.
During that ridiculous introduction, I mentioned going to the moon and wanting to know what you could and couldn't do. Could and couldn't do. That was the law part. How does moon relate to this other word in the title?
Well, the word lunar, of course, is an adjective describing all things related to the moon. Like all our listeners are probably familiar with the term the lunar calendar or lunar new year.
Yeah, that's right. Which is, you know, based on cycles in the moon.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So the question here today is one of lunar law. We have a subtitle which says, what the law says about buying property or protecting sites on the moon. And I would imagine it says very little.
Yeah. It is interesting. If you just look at that title, you might think, well, what is the law? There's no police officers on the moon. Are we talking about, you know, petty crime, chewing gum? Well, we're talking more about property and kind of space on the moon, right?
It's interesting. A little while ago, someone named an asteroid after our founder here.
Right.
I think it was an asteroid. Might have been a meteor.
Something like that, yeah.
But it was, it's kind of a special thing, I guess, if you're in that niche. But after that, we were talking about one of our younger coworkers was really enamored with that. And we were talking about buying a star for her.
Yes.
Because you can do this, right? You can go online and you pay some money and you get a certificate.
It's very easy. I think my father has one.
Yeah. Is that a real thing, though?
Well, it's a thing. You can pay money. I don't think it really has any standing, though.
The star has no idea that you have bought it.
Absolutely. And probably most other people have no idea that you bought it.
Well, this is obviously the problem then, right? Like, you have sort of decided it is your star, but other people don't know that, and it's very difficult to enforce. Same is true for the moon. Do you buy property on the moon when you can't get to the moon? Well, I don't know. Clearly, though, there's a race going on right now to get back to the moon between different groups that are interested in space exploration. And so I suppose this is becoming a more pressing issue. Now, listeners, we're going to do two readings today. If you have your February magazine, I would encourage you to open it up and join us as we do the first reading together now.
Lunar Law. What the law says about owning property or protecting sites on the moon. The moon could be the proving ground for humanity's evolution into a species that lives and thrives on more than one planet. However, this new frontier raises complex legal questions. Outer space, including the moon, from a legal perspective, is a unique domain without direct terrestrial equivalent. It is not like the high seas, the common heritage of humankind. Nor is it an area, like Antarctica, where commercial mining is prohibited. Instead, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, signed by more than 115 nations, including China, Russia, and the United States, establishes that the exploration and use of space are the province of all humankind. That means no country may claim territory in outer space, and all have the right to access all areas of the moon and other celestial bodies freely. The fact that, pursuant to Article 2 of the treaty, a country cannot claim territory in outer space, known as the non-appropriation principle, suggests to some that property ownership in space is forbidden.
Forbidden. Thank you so much, Linda, for that reading. Listeners, Linda, you know, does some extensive research into the pronunciation of words. Here, I don't see any that are particularly odd. This is going to be a fairly straightforward article, but we appreciate her hard work in preparing for those readings.
Absolutely.
Now, Garrett, there's this interesting term in the first sentence there, proving ground. What on earth is a proving ground?
Well, it almost makes me think of like practicing a martial art in like a dojo or a studio. It's kind of the space where you prove that you have what it takes, maybe with your teachers watching over. More colloquially, or I guess more in daily life usage, we use that to describe some arena, some space in which something is tried out and proven to be effective, so to speak.
That's a good general definition. When you mentioned the martial arts, I thought, like, that is not at all what comes to my mind when I think of proving ground. You know, I think of various science experiments and, you know, makerspace projects I've worked on over the years. You know, like you build a rocket for science class and then you have to fire it, right?
Yeah.
But you can't fire it in the classroom. You have to head
out
to a safe testing site. And that's what I think of as a proving ground, like a place where, you know, it's relatively safe, you know, it's not going to catch things on fire, you know, a good environment for testing things out. But that meets your general definition very well. Okay, so they're saying here that the moon is a proving ground for humanity's evolution into a species that lives and thrives on more than one planet. So this is the test site for us thriving on more than one planet. How is that?
The moon is a lot closer than other planets to us. And if we can survive there, it kind of has some similar characteristics to setting up spaces to live on other planets. Namely, there's not a lot of atmosphere there.
Yeah.
And so we can start to test things there. It's slightly less risky because it's closer. And we can develop the technologies or kind of the processes that we can then use elsewhere.
Yeah, you can sort of see a situation. Obviously, Elon Musk and his SpaceX, they spend a lot of time talking about going to Mars,
yes,
which is actually a very long way away.
Yeah.
So I suppose before they send some spaceship full of guys off to Mars, they'll stop by the moon and test out their gear. I guess that's basically the
idea.
We
don't want to end up like Matt Damon in The Martian.
The Martian,
right?
Stranded on the moon. Yeah, that's right. Oh, it was Mars. That's why he's the Martian.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a good spot. It's close to Earth. You know, it is in space. It's a very inhospitable environment, so it's a good place to test these things. But more than just testing equipment and gear, there are legal questions, complex legal questions that arise about the moon. It tells us outer space, including the moon, from a legal perspective, is a unique domain without a direct terrestrial equivalent. Now, when we say domain here, are we talking a web domain?
We're not. We're just saying a physical space on Earth. Or
I think of it as a property. A piece of property,
sure,
or space. So I guess a web domain, I mean, that's your www.gmail.com. That is your space on the internet, right?
Your portion that you have claimed.
Yeah. A domain is related to the word dominion, which we use to describe countries. Mm-hmm. Like that's actually Canada's name, the Dominion of Canada.
Mm.
So your space, it's a unique space without a direct terrestrial equivalent. Now, when we say terrestrial there, we mean
Earth. We're talking about Earth, and we're saying there's nothing directly just like it on Earth, even though there might be some things that share some characteristics.
Now, this word is not exclusively related to talking about space and Earth.
Mm.
I think you probably hear it most when you're talking about land versus water.
Sure.
So when I was a student, we talked a lot about marine environments, meaning in the ocean, versus terrestrial environments, meaning on land. So nonetheless, Earth on land, it is not like the high seas. Now, that term high seas, It has some sort of special connotation here.
Right. It is, of course, the oceans, but it's territory that is not under the purview of any country. It's outside of their exclusive economic zone. This is about 50% of Earth, and it's special because it's considered, like we see here, the common heritage of humankind. Anyone from any country can, to a certain extent, make use of what's in that territory.
So we've got a lot of seas, you know, the Sea of Japan, the South China Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all high sea, right? You were saying outside of a country's territory. So territories, you know, countries have like national waters that go out like 3 miles or 12 miles from their shore.
Yeah, the high seas are specifically even beyond that, outside of what we call the EEZ.
Would you say it's actually high?
Well, it's
not really, right?
It's, you can go further low.
It's deep. It's deep. Okay, so it's just a term that basically describes international waters there. And then it uses this quotation. It refers to the high seas as the common heritage of humankind. And I think the key words there are common and humankind. So the idea, when we use this word common, like commonwealth, the commons, it means things that are shared by everyone. And so that's kind of the idea. There are rules, obviously, for the high seas, but there are rules that are, you know, designed to allow access to everyone. Similarly, we have a whole continent, Antarctica. That's the continent in the southern hemisphere, where commercial mining is prohibited. So basically, those are also areas that are shared by all humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one person can do just whatever they want or own it, if you will. Now, instead, in contrast here, it turns out there's a space treaty. I was not aware of this. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty.
Right.
Have you heard of this?
This is the first time. We see it signed by more than 115 nations. That is most countries on Earth, including China, Russia, and the United States. Of course, the biggest countries on Earth.
Mm-hmm. And it establishes that the exploration and use of space are, and here's another quote, the province of all humankind. Meaning that no country may claim territory in outer space. Now, when I look at those two quotes, common heritage of humankind versus the province of all humankind, I don't see a huge distinction linguistically.
Sounds kind of the same to me.
But there is some sort of distinction, right? In that basically, but not enough of a distinction that anybody can claim either of them.
Sure.
You can't claim the ocean. You can't claim the moon.
Right.
Presumably.
Yes, we see that means no country may claim territory in outer space, and all have the right to access all areas of the moon and other celestial bodies freely.
That word celestial, I like that word.
It's a beautiful word.
Basically means space, outer space. So, you know, planets, suns, moons, things you find in space, those are celestial bodies.
Right.
Up in the sky, actually, I suppose.
It means the sky or the heavens.
Yeah. Okay. The fact that pursuant to Article 2 of the treaty, so that term pursuant to, that's kind of legal language. It means as it relates to or according to, as covered by Article 2 of the treaty, a country cannot claim territory in outer space, known as the non-appropriation principle. When you appropriate something, what are you doing with it?
You're kind of taking control of it, often against someone's will. We might use that word like a government appropriating land for some project. It could be like a transportation project.
There's a difference here between the word appropriate and appropriate. Right?
Absolutely.
What's the difference there?
They're just totally different words.
Appropriate means it's okay.
Yeah.
It fits. It's proper in the situation. But appropriate means you are taking for your own use. So non-appropriation principle means no one can take it for their own use. And so that's what it says. It suggests that some property ownership in space is forbidden. Pardon me. Suggests to some that property ownership in space is forbidden. So to some people. Now, by hinting to some people, you know, that suggests there might still be people who want to buy land in space.
There might be some gray area for some other interpretations.
Could you see yourself investing in property on the moon?
Maybe. Sounds cool.
I guess it depends on... It might be a very forward-looking, long-term investment.
Yes. You'd have to have some extra cash on hand.
Yeah. All right, listeners, that brings us to our second reading, where we get into the topic of ambiguous guidelines. Let's do that together now.
Ambiguous guidelines. Can this be true? If your grandchildren move to Mars, will they never own a home? How can a company protect its investment in a lunar mine if it must be freely accessible by all? What happens, as it inevitably will, when two rovers race to a particular area on the lunar surface known to host valuable water ice? Does the winner take all? As it turns out, the Outer Space Treaty does offer some wiggle room. Article 9 requires countries to show due regard for the corresponding interests of others. It is a legally vague standard, although the Permanent Court of Arbitration has suggested that due regard means simply paying attention to what's reasonable under the circumstances. The treaty's broad language encourages a race to the moon. The first entity to any spot will have a unilateral opportunity to determine what's legally reasonable. For example, creating an overly large buffer zone around equipment might be justified to mitigate potential damage from lunar dust.
All right, ambiguous. This means there's ambiguity.
Yes.
Right? Which means it's not clear.
It's not clear.
Yeah. So the guidelines are not clear. Now, I remember back when I was in college, I listened to this speaker who was talking about how most conflicts don't arise between good and evil, things that we clearly agree are good or evil. Most conflicts arise between good and good because people have placed different levels of priority on the different goods. So to some people, one thing is more important. To other people, the other thing is more important. And then those two groups end up in conflict.
I think that's true most of the time. Or we argue over how to get to the same conclusion.
Yeah. Now, this guy, he was a lawyer. So he was talking about the importance of being very clear and very specific, particularly not only in relaying the language of the law, but in relaying the intention so that other people can interpret it appropriately at a later time. Now, that clearly has not happened. But that I think that ambiguity, sometimes it arises because, you know, it's just hard to get, what was it, 115 countries to sign an agreement where they all agree to something very specific. But other times it's because things get dated. Like this was signed in 1967 at a time when, I don't know if it was super clear that people were going to be returning to the moon and then heading on to other planets.
That was before the moon landing, right?
Well, you know, it was around the time of the space race, that's for sure.
I think the moon landing was in 69.
But it's hard to tell, you know, because we're kind of members of the public. So it's hard to tell what the public was sort of fantasizing about and what the people at the good old National Aeronautic and Space Administration. I said it like that because I can't ever pronounce the acronym right because I'm Canadian.
NASA.
I always say NASA. And you guys say
NASA.
NASA. The people at NASA probably knew what the real limitations were, right? So anyway, you end up with these ambiguous agreements. So the question here, can this be true? What they're asking is whether or not people really cannot own the moon. So if your grandchildren move to Mars, will they never own a home? That's an interesting question, right?
Sure.
Because presumably at the time, everything was like a government-run program. So if you were on a space base, it was clearly run by NASA.
Yeah.
NASA, yeah. Okay. So this interesting question kind of arises. How can a company protect its investment in a lunar mine if it must be freely accessible by all? Well, that doesn't make very much sense, right? If you're going to set up a mine and then somebody else can just come and start digging out after all your hard work?
Yeah, without clear ownership of something, it's hard for investors to invest in something.
Yeah. What happens, as it inevitably will, when two rovers No, what's a rover?
A rover is like a vehicle, usually on wheels or maybe tracks, you know, moves across kind of a rugged space. We usually use that term for some vehicles that have gone to places like Mars.
Yeah, there was like kind of a car thing that the astronauts drove on the moon called the Moon Rover.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't really look like a car. It looked like an engine with some seats on a few wheels.
Yeah. And there have been a few different vehicles like this on Mars.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so these two rovers, they're racing to a particular area on the lunar surface, so somewhere up on the moon, that's known to host valuable water ice. Does the winner take all? Yeah. These are good questions they're raising here. As it turns out, the Outer Space Treaty, though, Garrett, does offer some wiggle room.
Wiggle room. That's a great term. Some wiggle room, meaning that these laws are not quite so black and white, not quite so clear, that there's no room to interpret things. There is a little bit of wiggle room.
Article 9, it tells us, this is of that space treaty, requires countries to show due regard for the corresponding interests of others. It is a legally vague standard, I'll say. Like, does that mean you do own the mine you've built or not? Or does that just mean if you are racing to the ice water in your rover and you get there first, you have to leave some for the next guy?
Yeah. Due regard is a very ambiguous term.
Regard really just means you think about, and due means something you have a responsibility for, right? Yeah. Due diligence, for example, means something you owe. So, and you owe a thought to the needs of others there. That's kind of the idea. So, what's it tell us? It says it's a legally vague standard. Although the Permanent Court of Arbitration has suggested that due regard means simply paying attention to what's reasonable under the circumstances. Again, they have answered an ambiguous guideline with an ambiguous interpretation. What is reasonable under the circumstances?
Yeah, my question is, if the Permanent Court of Arbitration, so some court that's deciding between two disputing parties, has made a determination on this, that means there is some sort of case that different people have brought to the court. So what? There has been
what
some
the
dispute.
Case?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Even though we don't have like settlements on the moon yet.
That is an interesting question.
Yeah.
Well worth some research. It says the treaty's broad language encourages a race to the moon. Now let's think about that. How does it encourage a race to the moon? I suppose it's because it leaves open what you can do on the moon. So if you get there first and you feel that what you are doing is reasonable and considerate of others, then you can do whatever you want. But if someone else is there first, then they can do whatever they want. You kind of have to fight for what's left over.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old adage that you do something first and then apologize later. If you already start doing something, it's kind of hard for others to stop you after the fact.
How do we say that adage? We say it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Right, exactly.
Right? So you do it first and then you ask someone to forgive you rather than getting their permission to do it, because that takes a lot longer.
And after you've started, kind of some of those lines might start to clear up later, but at that point you've already kind of staked your claim.
Yeah. We actually have a term for this in business English too, right? We talk about first mover advantage.
Yeah.
Right? We also talk about greenfield industries, which basically means like an area where no one has been or used it. Mm-hmm. So you're in like new territory.
Yeah.
That's kind of the idea here. It tells us here that the first entry to any spot, obviously, will have a unilateral opportunity.
That's the first entity to any spot.
Oh.
For all our listeners.
Sure. Unilateral. Una there means one, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have other words like bilateral, trilateral, multilateral, which all deal with the different numbers of parties.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's one party is acting.
Which basically means if you are the first one, you get to decide by yourself. If there are two of you who arrive, that's bilateral and you have to decide together. So you have this unilateral opportunity to determine what's legally reasonable. And then it gives us an example, Garrett. What's that?
Mm. creating an overly large buffer zone around equipment might be justified to mitigate potential damage from lunar dust. Now, this example talks about one specific problem that is quite specific to the moon that you might not face in a lot of places in the terrestrial world.
Yeah, but I've seen that movie, The Martian. You know that's a dusty-looking place.
Yes.
So Martian dust is probably also going to be a problem.
Yeah, I would say it, just not as much on Earth.
Yeah. Well, we have water that isn't ice.
So a buffer zone would be kind of an area where you're not actually doing things. Your equipment is not in the buffer zone, but it keeps your things safe and separated from whatever's happening outside that buffer zone.
If you think of new buildings that have been put up in the last few years in urban areas around us, like in the city we're living in, there's generally kind of a space between the building and the sidewalk, right? Meaning the building is built back a little bit from the sidewalk. I think technically they call that public space, though it's not for the public, it's for the people who own the property. You know, so sometimes they'll put like a wall up and there will be a garden or things like that. That, though, is a buffer space, a buffer zone, because it separates the building itself from the actual public space. And so their example here where they're talking about dust, presumably what they mean is you want to you know, have your equipment stored safely away from outside influences so you have a space around it to kind of protect it. That would be the idea there. Now, listeners, we obviously have not worked through the entire topic of lunar law here. We have a lot more to do tomorrow, but we are running out of time. And so Garrett and I are going to have to say goodbye for now. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.